Good morning, and ecstatic equinoctial equanimity. My name is Michael McCusker. KMUN listeners are surely aware that the annual autumn pledge drive week has started, raking in the seasonal green. It is transfusion infusion season. So while you think about making that phone call, 503-325-0010, to keep KMUN on the lower FM dial, I will try to give you a good reason to do so with a brief and selective history of American journalism in my raspy, aged voice, followed by Dr. Robert Brake with fizzy comment. I start with mine, which I titled Mediocrity Galore. One of the most remarkable human innovations has been the newspaper, which quite naturally followed invention of the printing press, first conceived in China, has had so many things, good and bad. Radio, television, and the internet are, in essence, mere improvisations of the original concept of mass communications, which the newspaper essentially pioneered. The newspaper idea did not itself appear whole cloth. Pamphleteering, leaflets, broadside proclamations nailed to the church door, so to speak, and such printed ilk preceded the radical notion of newsmongering for its own sake. Yet newspapers chronicled, in the words of the late Gene Fowler, history shot on the wing, however biased or fabricated. This Saturday is the 331st anniversary of the first newspaper published in the English North American colonies, Public Occurrences, which appeared on the streets of Boston, Massachusetts on September 25th, 1690, but was soon suppressed because of unkind remarks about the British Crown. 45 years later, in 1735, John Peter Zenger was put on trial and acquitted for defamation against the English king in his newspaper, the New York Weekly Journal, which raised issues of a free press that contributed directly to the First Amendment half a century later. 30 years after Zenger's trial, Thomas Paine wrote a pamphlet, a popular form of 18th century dialectic journalism, Common Sense, which inflamed the American Revolution and later Rights of Man, which was made the rationale of the French Revolution of 1789. The persistent image of colonial America as a society in which freedom of expression was cherished is a hallucination that ignores history, Leonard W. Levy wrote in his book, The Emergence of a Free Press. The term liberty of the press refers to the fact of printing free from prior restraint and not at all the matter printed, whether good or bad, Thomas Paine wrote. Yet a free press emerged after the American Revolution, protected by the First Amendment to the new Yankee Doodle Constitution, which was ratified in 1789, though the Bill of Rights seemed almost an afterthought tacked onto the Constitution as its first 10 amendments by popular demand and adopted into law as the basic rights of the common citizenry. The First Amendment guarantees the necessaries, freedom of speech and a free press, in the assumption that liberty survives only in an atmosphere of free and open expression of thought and expression, no matter how diverse or uncomfortable. Also is included freedom of religion, or none, and assembly, and the right to demand government undue wrongs it commits. The First Amendment is the guardian of the rest. It guarantees their continued substantiality and acts as a structural mainframe for constitutional American democracy. A most important assumption of a democracy is that the free flow of information not be restrained or fallaciously tampered with. But, of course, interfering and manipulating information is a major priority of attaining and maintaining malign, pervasive political power. The First Amendment has not prevented incessant attempts to impose obdurate religious or political dogma into public mandates. The excessive repression of the McCarthy era of the 1950s, for example, ruined the lives and professions of many of the nation's best writers, artists, actors, and musicians. Christian fundamentalists have tried to ban books from public libraries for decades, and numerous other censorious groups demand control over the contents of school textbooks and everything from internet pornography to Mother Goose. Right-wing Republican officials endeavor at present to prevent the history of racial bigotry being taught in public schools. And the consummate deceiver, Donald Trump, will shred the Constitution to regain the presidency and abdicate democracy. Freedom of expression is maintained at high cost and is always threatened with malignant repressions. The true purpose of the First Amendment, guarantee of a free press, is to act as a conscience to authority, but also as a critical watchdog and as a cry of alarm when authority is exceeded or corrupt. The real purpose of the journalistic media is little understood, which is as much its fault as it is from public skepticism and distrust. A free and open flow of information, regardless of ideology or opinion, despite the strenuous labor of separating truth from fiction, deceit, gossip, and obscenity, information from disinformation, is quite truthfully the essential method of preserving what remains of our freedoms and enlarging them in a turbulent world that is recoiling from the morbidity of its own virulence. Above all, however difficult it may be to define journalism, its most basic mandate is to be truthful, honest, and open with its readers, its viewers, and listeners. It must act as a forum, an instrument of public dialogue and debate, presenting differing views, even as Supreme Court Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes wrote, expressing opinion that we loathe and believe to be fraught with death. Commercial distortion of First Amendment intent of media has continually given rise to independent publications and to free speech TV and public radio stations such as Astoria's KMUN-FM and Portland's KBOO. The independent media, which has few pretensions towards objectivity and fewer illusions about its probability, provides a vital forum that mega media generally ignores for the exchange, analyses, understanding, and argument of issues that are at the base of every culture and society. Alternative media's lineage reaches back to the rough and prickly press that gave birth to the First Amendment. And though it seldom reflects what constitutes so-called popular opinion and operates on the cultural edge where mega media is reluctant to go, the independent micromedia is powered by the belief that if it does not remain free, nothing soon after will be free. Small, undernourished print and electronic maverick media advocates are large on seeking answers and truths. Though never quite satisfyingly pure, truth in the real world must be free of deceit and distortion. It must be like a rock or a star, a fact defined by its existence. Astoria's KMUN, which has been on air for 38 years, since April 17, 1983, and is amidst its annual Autumn Pledge Drive this week, is like most public radio stations on the far left spectrum of the radio dial, which commercial radio covets. KMUN offers just about everything a radio station can attempt to do and operates daily on the cultural edge where mega media fears to follow, except to control and co-opt whatever might seem profitable. KMUN broadcasts an eclectic smorgasbord of imaginative, provocative, exotic, and occasionally dreadful programming. It is seldom bland or boring. One of KMUN's earlier program directors, Joe Vincentia, wrote in the station's mostly monthly program guide, The Current, in March 1995, "We all know what public broadcasting is, or do we? Just like happiness, public broadcasting means different things to different people. Actually, I have come to wonder if we are all viewing and listening to the same programming. Some turn on their radio and hear a liberal-based attack on American society and values, calling for the dismantlement of all we hold dear and true. While others can't stand to listen or watch, because all they see and hear is an agent of propaganda for the corporate monsters with designs on breeding all the life and free will from each and every person on the land, which they are poisoning, by the way. We are anarchistic, provocative, reckless, dangerously passive. You name it, we've been called it." Vincenza wondered why Congress wants to destroy public broadcasting. Is it because we are too liberal? Is it because the government is over budget? Is it because Rupert Murdoch wants the frequencies? Is it because the Corporation for Public Broadcasting pays its executives too much? Is it because we cater to society's elite? Do we deal with too much truth? Do we live too many lies? Is it something I've completely missed? Is it too much politics? And that was Joe Vincentia, former program director of KMUN. American society undervalues endeavors that do not seek profit. Big money radio broadcasts for big bucks. Public radio scrounges for loose change to stay on the air. Community radio stations like KMUN are always looking for a dollar to broadcast. It is a listener-sponsored station that depends on its funding, primarily from listeners, which is why folks who listen to KMUN are subjected a couple of times a year to pitches, pleas, and whines for new and old members to pledge cash. Commercial stations reduce their listeners to consumers and treat them as empty-headed children amuck in a toy store. Controversy, original ideas, and experimental broadcasting are anathema to commercial radio and TV, which depend instead upon innocuous pabulum focused on the primordial mental range to hype the unnecessary and indigestible. Cradle-to-grave consumerism is not the focus of public radio like KMUN, nor is pandering to perpetual adolescence. Instead, KMUN and its sister stations attempt to counter the trend of addictive adolescent grievance with appeals to adult responsibility in an increasingly complex and corrupt democracy. Throughout this horrific pandemic, most volunteer programmers record from home while a skeleton crew operates the station in the beautiful Tillicum House, donated to KMUN by Helen Hill a quarter of a century ago. KMUN is a class act, even and especially under stress. That was something that I wrote. And now, from Dr. Robert Brake of Ocean Park, Washington, we have no right to vote. Many Americans regard voting as a duty, an obligation, or even a sacred right. Numerous highly regarded documents attest to its significance. See the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, the Charter of the Organization of American States, and the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. But not all is clearly defined or accepted by many Americans. Some even regard voting as an act of little consequence or significance. Trying not to parse or hair split, I ask you to imagine what would happen if contemporary Americans were asked to vote on adoption of the U.S. Constitution as originally drafted, stripped of all changes over the last two centuries. Our nation of more than 330 million lives in a time and place where, as President George W. Bush pledged in his second inaugural address, it is the policy of the United States to seek and support the growth of democratic movements and institutions in every nation and culture, with the ultimate goal of ending tyranny in our world. Imbued as we are with that spirit, if we were transported back to the winter of 1787-88 and asked to vote on the Constitution, we might recoil at some of its provisions. The original document establishing our government acknowledges and weaves slavery deeply into our society. Women cannot vote, and two of the three major federal offices, president and senator, are not voted on by the people. Further, the Founding Fathers made no explicit mention of the right to vote, and there was no right to vote in the Constitution until Amendments 12, 14, 15, 17, 19, 20, 25, and 28. The word vote appears in the Constitution only in relation to how representatives, senators, and presidential electors perform their duties. Representatives vote. In fact, while they are performing their duties in the House, they are immune from arrest for most crimes. But the people's vote is not mentioned. Consequently, an individual's vote is neither protected nor guaranteed. The phrase right to vote simply does not appear in the Constitution, nor does it appear in the Bill of Rights. The founders wrote a constitution that gave Congress the right to pass copyright and bankruptcy laws, the right to borrow money, the right to establish post offices. Exactly how long is a mile? Congress is granted the power to say. In other words, to fix the standards of weights and measures, quote unquote. Congress was required to keep a journal of its proceedings. Members of Congress were guaranteed a salary. Amid this wealth of detail, scarcely a word is spent on how the people are to vote or how their consent to be governed is to be assessed. Even in the wake of the Bill of Rights, which made a slew of individual rights explicit, the Constitution did not mention a right to vote. The right to assemble and petition government was established. The right to keep and bear arms, to a jury trial, to a speedy trial in criminal cases, to due process of law, to confront witnesses in criminal cases. Yes. Voting rights, no. It's almost as if in the course of constructing a house, the contractor ordered the refrigerator and stove, the windows and curtains, the roof shingles, bought all the interior paint and built the swimming pool, but he completely forgot about the foundation. Of course, the founders were not so oblivious, and contrary to many common accounts, they were not stiff-necked anti-democratic elitists hostile to the swarm of unwashed voters. But during the hot summer in Philadelphia in 1787, when they were writing the Constitution, the old adage that politics is the art of the possible held sway. The decision not to address voting rights in the Constitution was not an oversight. It was a pragmatic decision. It was not politically practicable to impose uniform suffrage, i.e., voting laws across the original colonies. If the founders had tried to do so, they would have ignited a conflict among states, each of which had distinct traditions and approaches to voting. A uniform federal approach to voting would have overridden some states' traditions and inflamed a substantial number of the states needed for the document's ratification. Was the new, fragile federal government really going to tell South Carolina that free blacks could vote? Or was it going to have to do the opposite and tell Massachusetts, which did allow blacks to vote, that it would have to ban their voting? A uniform federal voting system was a bridge too far. It was easier to let state laws and provisions dealing with the vote stand. After all, almost all elections were local. Only one of the newly created federal offices was subject to direct popular vote. Neither senators nor the president were elected by the general population. Only members of the House of Representatives stood before the people before election. The Constitution, in effect, integrated whatever the states might say about the right to vote into the new federal system. Each state was required to have a Republican form of government, but no more than that. In the time that passed, once our founding document was adopted, nothing has been more sharply disputed than our voting rights. Not taxation policy, not government regulation, not our safety net, Social Security, Medicare, welfare, not railroads, not the internet, not freedom of speech, not health care. Nothing rivals the intensity of, the importance of, or the blood spilled over our nation's debate on the right to vote, a subject that was ambiguously and elliptically avoided in the Constitution. Today, in the wake of a civil war that left more than 600,000 dead, 8 constitutional amendments, 2 monumental social protest movements, the youth quake of the 1960s, the transformative lawmaking of Congress in 1965, and the convulsions of the 2000 presidential election, most Americans feel reasonably confident that they have something approaching a right to vote. Or maybe it's just a privilege. To a degree, the easiest way to think about our voting rights system is as a sedimentary rock formation, its layers laid down and intermingled over centuries with federal and state constitutional provisions, laws, and regulations evolving over the course of our history. But the fundamental layer, the right to vote, has never been laid. Sure, there is no overreaching federal right to vote in our Constitution. On a national level, the right to vote might best be understood in the negative. The United States has universal suffrage, almost. The vote cannot be denied to a citizen on the basis of race, gender, age, once the voter is age 18, our ability to read or to pay a poll tax. But some categories of people can still indisputably have the right to vote denied. Felons or non-citizens, for example. An individual's vote cannot be diluted, made to count less than another person's. However, as simple as it might be to formulate the principle, one man, one vote, implementation is not nearly so straightforward. and the right to vote, to the extent there is one, must be equally protected, though, like one man, one vote, implementing equal protection is not clear-cut. Beyond that, whether one has a right to vote is largely a matter of state law. The right to vote in the most practical sense, the way people cast their ballots and have them counted, can be restricted and made difficult in numerous ways. And whether efforts to restrict the ability to vote go too far is determined by a blend of state and federal law. The bottom line, voters in the United States simply have no constitutional right to vote for president. The fact that Americans can vote for the electors who then vote for the president is a generous gift given by state legislatures. They are free to take it back whenever they want. And that was We Have No Right to Vote by Dr. Robert Brake of Ocean Park, Washington. This is Michael McCusker. Dylan Hauser Schalk is this program's engineer. So here we are again, like Buddhist monks with their begging bowls. We non-capitalist heretics need your money to preach our communalist doctrines. We ask you to pledge as though your very sanity depends on it, which might be a fundamental truth. Resurgence of the evil plague has forced a retreat back to social abstinence. Fortunately, KMUN remains on the air to inform, enlighten, and entertain our renewed sense of quarantine. If you are a regular listener and supporter of community radio, you know all this. You've been through the drill however many times in the 38 years of Coast Community Radio. So call in now and pledge for quality community radio, 503-325-0010. And remember, protecting yourself during this viral resurgence helps protect everybody else in true community solidarity. Happy autumn equinox.